House Fisheries Committee will come to order. It's Tuesday, March 29th, 2016, 10:04, and we are in room 120. Welcome, everybody. We have here with us today Representative Herron, Representative Ortiz, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum. We also have Kelly Burnett from House Records. Welcome, Kelly. Matt Kern from the LIO. And, of course, Reed Harris, my Fisheries Committee aide. Thank you, Reed. We have an appointment for Alan Kane for the Board of Fisheries, and we will follow that with House Bill 241, an act relating to the non-resident surcharge for commercial fishing permits. First up, we have Alan Kane, who is being appointed to the Board of Fisheries. I'd like to make a note that recommendations from this committee do not ensure supporting votes from the committee members at the joint session. Mr. Kane, please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chairwoman Stutes. My name is Alan Kane, and I would just like to introduce myself. I'm sorry you can't see me. I'm in a very impressive meeting room here at the LIO in Anchorage, and I'm honored to be before the committee this morning. Professionally, I have over 40 years of experience enforcing fisheries in Alaska. I have been an Alaska wildlife trooper for 25 of those years. I was the criminal justice planner for the Department of Fish and Game for 10, and I've been a contractor assisting various state agencies for 5 additional years to help manage and sustain our fisheries, game populations, and habitat in Alaska. It's been a wonderful career, and perhaps this opportunity to serve will be a good one for me and my family. Just a little bit about my philosophy. My first and abiding concern is for the health and sustainability of our fisheries and shellfish populations in Alaska. But right next to that is also my concern for the people and families here in Alaska. I spent 15 years assisting in the Board of Fisheries process, attending meetings as the enforcement advisor for the Alaska Board of Fisheries, so I have quite a bit of experience with the process. But I've also been on many of the harvesting vessels and been to subsistence fish camps and personal use fisheries and sport fisheries all across the state, so I have a pretty wide experience spectrum in that regard. That's really all I have for opening. Madam Chair, if you have questions, I would happily entertain them.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from this committee? Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kane, I've read your resume, and it is outstanding. Are you currently a contractor for the Board of Fisheries?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I am not a contractor for the Board of Fisheries. That, in my understanding, is a semi-state position that one moves into once they're appointed. I do advise the Department of Fish and Game on various regulations and help with enforcement applications, and I provide training to the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources at this time as a contractor, but I don't have any contract duties that will relate to the Board of Fisheries once I'm appointed to the board.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative.
So, Mr. Kane, you're a retired state employee?
Representative Herron, that's correct. My wife finally convinced me that jumping out of perfectly good helicopters in the Gulf of Alaska and swimming through upside-down sinking boats was something I should move on from, so I've moved a little more to the public service side of things instead of the direct enforcement.
So, Mr. Kane, I would say you have a very smart spouse.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Herron, I completely agree, and I pretty much at this point in life, I try to do what she says.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kane, because you've been around the Board of Fish, and, of course, now you are a potential participant directly on the Board of Fish, what is the biggest, from your perspective, what is the biggest challenge for any person or for the Board of Fish in general in terms of fulfilling your duties as the Board of Fish?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, that's a wonderful and challenging question. I would say, from my experience, allocation is always the most difficult task before the board. As you well know, many of our fisheries, both shellfish and finfish, throughout the state, have more people who would like to enjoy the benefits of harvesting them than is sustainable. And the board comes into the allocation effort, and there is always passionate debate by sometimes polarized groups, and emotions run high. The very well-being of families is often represented to be at stake, and the board members need to use wisdom and care and listen very carefully to all the concerns that come before them and recognize that sometimes there are interests that are not represented at the board meeting, so there's a great deal of reading that's involved, and all of that goes into the decision-making process to help allocate our precious fisheries. That would be the toughest challenge I've observed over the years.
Follow-up, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as an observer of the Board of Fish up to this point, how well do you think that that body has fulfilled that mission and accomplished that most difficult task?
Excuse me for 1 minute. I'd just like to recognize Representative Millett has joined us. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Kane. I'm sorry for the interruption.
No problem. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. I have been very, very impressed my entire career. Certainly there are occasional anomalies that occur, but for the great majority of the time, I have been very impressed with the care, the diligence that has been given by board members. I've known and worked with quite a few of them over the years, and for the most part, I have great confidence in the process. I think for the most part, it's very fair. And I would be honored to assist and help out. That's what I would view my position as, is just a helper to keep our resources available for generations to come. That's pretty much my view.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Mr. Kane, you certainly do. This is Representative Stutz, and you certainly do have an impressive resume. And I didn't note in here, but I think I will ask for the record anyway. Have you ever been a commercial fisherman?
Chairman Stutz, yes, I have. When I was 15 years old, I worked an entire summer for 2 months on an Alaska purse seiner out of the village of Cake in southeast Alaska. I spent 2 weeks on a Bering Sea crabber fishing for a red king crab in the Bering Sea, and understand that show about the most dangerous catch very clearly. Those are the two times I worked aboard a vessel. I've operated commercial fishing gear every time I was ever allowed to do it in the learning process. Power troll gear, drift gill nets, set nets, anything that I could ever operate or do, I have done. I've participated in personal use fisheries, subsistence fisheries, sport fisheries, and commercial fisheries during my time.
Thank you. It appears as though you've got quite a diverse knowledge of all the different fishing sectors and gear types as well. Thank you, Mr. Kane. Representative Heron.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman, for allowing me to ask a couple more questions. Mr. Kane, you were appointed 2 months ago. Have you had the chance to be in Board of Fish meetings yet?
Representative Heron, I was not appointed 2 months ago. I don't remember the exact date, but I think it was about 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
When the prior board member resigned, I was put into that position, and I believe there are 2 years remaining from his appointment that I would serve until my term expired. So I did go down to the statewide FinFish meeting and listened in a little bit and participated just as a member of the audience.
Because, Madam Chair, my follow-up question would have been if you had actually been a board member, even though of all these years that you've been around the board, it's a little different when you're actually sitting in the chair, as every legislator around here knows, is that my question would have been what has surprised you and what has disappointed you by being sitting in the chair as an actual board member. But can't ask that question. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Are there any further questions from this committee? Seeing none, I will open up public comment. It appears there is no one online. Is there anyone here that would like to comment on the Board of Fish appointment to Mr. Kane? Seeing none, I will close public comment. May I have a motion, please?
Sure. I'll read from the motion that your staff has supplied. Madam Chair, I move that this committee approve Mr. Kane as a candidate for the Board of Fisheries and that his resume be forwarded to the joint session.
Seeing no objection, we will forward Mr. Kane's name. Thank you, Mr. Kane, for your time.
Thank you very much.
Brief at ease. On record, and we'd like to welcome Representative Foster, who's here to join us. Next, we have House Bill 241, an act relating to the non-resident surcharge for commercial fishing permits. This is the second hearing for this bill. Grace, if you would like to come forward, please, and state your name for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Charisse Millett. And if it pleases the committee, I might just address some of the concerns that were brought up in the last committee and some of the resolutions we believe that we've come to at this point.
Wonderful.
So during our last hearing, there was a lot of discussion about using the criteria for permanent fund dividend eligibility as a way to determine resident versus non-resident for the purposes of permit fees. And one of the resolutions that we discussed, both with our Ledge Legal as well as with the Department of Fish and Game, CFEC, and the Department of Revenue, is the way in which the bill is drafted. And we really do sometimes have a fantastically deft team over at Legislative Legal, and they explained the way in which it was drafted was to allow as broad authority as possible for the commission, for CFEC to allow for the determination of eligibility for a permanent fund dividend without having to have the person actually apply for the dividend. So were a person to state that they were eligible based on the criteria that we have for permanent fund eligibility, and that just determines residency without the consideration of perhaps a felony on your record or other limitations that we have for the permanent fund dividend, that the department and CFEC should be able to determine that eligibility without having to have the person apply. Another situation that we had discussed is in the case of someone not wanting to apply for the dividend because they presume themselves ineligible, at which point they would be able to look through the criteria to determine whether or not that was in fact the case. In the case that someone is most likely to have their permanent fund dividend garnished or taken from them as a result of some sort of civil court action, that they would also be able to go beyond the, or they would not be limited by having to apply for the PFD to determine their residency. And if you look at the criteria within the bill, it does limit the definition of resident to just the permanent fund statutes related to residency. So it's AS 43230005, pardon me, A subsections 2-7, and those are limited to just the residency requirements. They don't include someone's lack of eligibility based on a criminal record, for instance.
Thank you. Are there any questions here?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I think our drafter, Alpheus, Bullard is online, and if you have any more specific questions about why it's drafted the way it is, basically what Grace is saying is the amendments that we talked about last meeting, they're not necessary. Ledge Legal doesn't believe that they're necessary because we're broad enough in here that they will have the authority either by regulation or by statute that they could qualify someone for a resident license without being a permanent fund receiver.
Thank you. And I would also like to note that we have, one of our CFEC commissioners, Ben Brown, here, and we also have the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, Mr. Kevin Brooks. Welcome to you both. Thank you for coming. We have Alpheus Bullard. Thank you for that. So are there any questions? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might have a question for Commissioner Brown and or Deputy Commissioner Brooks.
Well, why don't you ask your question, and then we'll let one of them come forward.
Wonderful. My question is several part, maybe more for the CFEC to get a sense of what sort of enforcement or corroboration actions have been taken in the past to determine residency or a lack of residency for those claiming residency and therefore paying the discounted resident fees. And then a question for either Kevin or Ben is, I can't say I've been super savvy in all the details and legal nuance of the administration's order reorganizing a lot of these duties between these two entities, but how would this responsibility of corroborating who is resident by PFD criteria, who would that fall to given the administration's administrative action?
Gentlemen, maybe you could both step forward. Thank you.
Well, I think I can try to answer the first part of the question. Benjamin Brown, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And there was a memorandum from Frank Glass, who's our adjudications chief, that I believe Mr. Harris distributed to the members of the committee. Representative Millett had seen it, Madam Chairman, I think, before when she was working on the bill. And it describes some of what we did in the past. But basically, if you look at our permit forms, our application or our renewal forms, the applicant has to sign on a dotted line that says, under penalty of perjury, I attest that everything on here is true. That includes ticking the box that says, I'm a resident. And just in preparation for this morning's hearing, I went ahead and looked at the Code of Criminal Law. So you're all aware perjury and related offenses are at 1156-200 at SEC. And although our forms say under penalty of perjury, people are generally not charged with perjury. Because it isn't really a sworn statement where they have their hand on a Bible. They're charged with unsworn falsification. And there's two levels of unsworn falsification in the criminal code in Alaska. The first is in the first degree, and that's restricted only to when you're applying for a permanent fund dividend. It kind of circles back around. And then the second degree, which is a Class B misdemeanor, is the garden variety form. So really, if you read Mr. Glass's memo, which I hope you had a copy of, it's about 4 pages long, it sort of describes what we had done in the past and why we have not been in the business of having investigators go out and actively try to, you know, follow people around and see if they're really getting their mail somewhere, if they're really voting because they're registered to vote. And what Mr. Glass recommends is, and this is, we've actually had some cases of this in the past couple of years, if someone's claiming residency in another state, that's the best way to bust them, for want of a better word, when they try to claim Alaska residency as well. So going forward, we would simply, as it says in the analysis in our fiscal note, change the forms so that we don't want to play gotcha. We would put them on notice that when they signed that form and they said they were a resident, that they were attesting that they were a resident under the stricter standard of receipt of a permanent fund dividend. And they probably wouldn't be guilty of for unsworn falsification in the first degree because they're not applying for a dividend, but they are saying that they're eligible for a dividend when they're applying for their renewal. So the penalties of a Class B misdemeanor would be out there, and in the past we have had people charged with that for falsely claiming Alaska residency when they're applying for a permit renewal.
A follow-up on that point, Madam Chair. Just as a sense of scale, how many people historically?
I've not prepared a spreadsheet on that, but it's not very many. I mean, to be quite honest, I think you could safely describe our current system as the honor system. You know, that unless we have someone bring to our attention that someone has falsely claimed residency, and then we refer it to public safety, we don't have staff to, you know, have investigators going out. We could do that. That would be a change in our business model. But currently, it's more or less the honor system. When someone says he's a resident or she's a resident for purposes of getting a permit renewal, we believe them unless contravening facts are brought to our attention. So, you know, not even in the hundreds, I would say.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Did you have a second question?
Well, I had another question up front with how does all of this shake out with the sort of administrative reorganization between ADFNG and CFEC, corroborating residency?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game, and Representative Chris Tompkins. I would envision it to be pretty much business as usual. Under the administrative order, if the department was issuing those permits, you know, we have similar functions on the licensing side. As Mr. Brown pointed out, it's an unsworn falsification. We work with the troopers currently if we suspect that somebody isn't. We work with Permanent Fund Dividend currently on issuing permanent ID cards. In fact, that's one of our checks right away. It's a lifetime benefit. So if we get an application for a permanent ID card, we're already checking with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. If that individual received a PFD in the prior year, they automatically get that card. If they didn't, we have other ways for them to prove residency, utility bills, things like that. So it's a process that we currently do. It's a process that we would continue under a change in structure.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we were to adopt and pass House Bill 241, would that enhance the process that currently happens now and make a higher level of verification possible? Would it improve the situation?
Well, speaking, Madam Chairman, Representative Ortiz, Ben Brown from CFEC again. Speaking to the status quo, thank you, Mr. Brooks, it's a more stringent standard. You know, but I think, frankly, and I just was going to point this out, as I was reading the most recent issue of the Bar Rag about the adoption of the marijuana regulations, that's the standard for getting one of the marijuana licenses, that you have to get a dividend. You know, in these straightened fiscal times, I wouldn't, and it's a policy call, I guess is what I would say. Whatever the legislature in its wisdom tells us to do at CFEC in terms of whether or not someone is deserving of being considered a resident, we will implement that to the best of our ability. I'm sure any part of state government would do that. So I think it's a policy call. It might be over-inclusive, as Mr. Glass's memo says. It could be over-inclusive and under-inclusive at the same time, but we won't know till we start doing it, and then we would work those wrinkles out. But I think as a general answer, Madam Chair, I would say, Representative Ortiz, it would raise the bar, and once the kinks got ironed out, it would probably result in a truer assessment of non-resident surcharges from those who really should be paying them.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question that I have is if a non-resident says they're a resident and they don't pay the surcharge, and then later we find out, we go after them, et cetera. But is there any other collateral benefit besides not having to pay the surcharge that a permit holder would gain?
Madam Chairman, Representative Herron, I can't think of one. I mean, the benefit is you don't pay the surcharge. I guess there's the intangible benefit of knowing that you're an Alaskan, but I think in terms of quantifiable benefits, I don't, which is a real benefit. But I don't, frankly, Madam Chair, I don't see any other benefit that a person would take away. And I was discussing this with Representative Millett's staff a little bit. You know, the surcharge for this year and the next 2 years is $215. A dividend is, well, it may be $2,000 this year, and then who knows what the future holds. None of us can predict that right at this point in time. But I imagine some people who didn't want to deal with it would consider $215 annually the cost of doing business. And they might just say, forget it, I'm just going to pay the surcharge. I mean, I think some people, you know, busy fishermen who fish a bunch of different fisheries who have accountants who do their mail for them are probably just going to say, just pay the damn thing. Pardon my colloquial phraseology, but I think that's what a fisherman might say.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from this committee? Seeing none, I will open up public testimony. I see no one online. Is there anyone here that would like to testify on House Bill 241? Testifying on House Bill 241? Seeing no one, I will close public testimony. And are there no further questions from this committee? Seeing none, may I have a motion to move this bill from committee?
Anybody? Madam Chair?
No.
Nope.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative Christ-Compkins.
I move House Bill 241, Non-Resident Surcharge Commercial Fishing, 29/LS1253/alpha from this committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objection from this committee, House Bill 241 is reported out of House Fisheries Committee. Thank you. And there is no scheduled meeting for March 31st, Thursday. We will meet again on Tuesday, April 5th. And with that, we will have adjournment at 10:32.